We'll go on to case number three, which is Witte versus the Wisconsin Department of Corrections, appeal number 043962. And we'll give Mr. Pines just a minute to get himself together. Lost your audience.
Are you ready for me?
I'm ready.
Thank
We're
you very
ready
much,
for
Your
you.
Honor. Judge Rovner, may it please the court. Mr. Pines, this is a case about an employer using the vehicles that we honor for due process as actual weapons against the employee, literally turning shields into swords. And the ultimate attempt to do so is now before this court, the question of whether Dr. Witte had to avail himself of arbitration once again, instead of turning to this court or to the federal courts for proper relief. The evidence in this case, supporting the conclusion that this case belongs here, is strong. The affidavit of the union representative, Douglas Swanson, that the union felt that arbitration would have been futile. His observation that the pre-termination hearings and meetings were a sham through and through. The affidavits of Dr. Lotson and nurse practitioner Meyer, that Dr. Witte was an exemplary doctor who acted with excellence and better than most.
Mr. Lasker, let me just begin with the idea that the various inquiries and issues that had arisen were all sham. The Wisconsin Department of Corrections points out that in the arbitrator's decision, the first arbitrator, well, the arbitrator's decision,
yes,
in the arbitration that actually happened, although it ordered Dr. Witte's reinstatement, on page 11 there's a paragraph quoted which is hardly a ringing endorsement. It seems to have given WDOC the green light to go ahead and pursue what had been problems. He concludes it's the arbitrator's hope that he will modify his behavior and attitude and so on and so forth. I don't see how, when complaints are made, you can tell somebody like the Department of Corrections not to look into them, at least to see what basis there is. And it appears that this isn't just the there's no evidence that they're abusing this process.
Well, the
other than Dr. Witte's word for it, but we need something other than that.
Well, the accusations that were made against Dr. Witte after his reinstatement were all complaints by senior management themselves, not something that had to be looked into.
Why is that important? I mean, he was reinstated. The arbitrator has pretty much said, you know, you went over the line to fire him, but other measures could well be appropriate.
Yes, and he indicated that two matters he thought could be matters of verbal reprimand, and as soon as Dr. Witte was reinstated, they were made written reprimands that were put into his file.
Why is that a constitutional difference if it was worthy of reprimand at all? I realize written has a somewhat longer shelf life, perhaps, but I don't really. I mean, here are the problems. First of all, there is process available. It's unfortunate Dr. Witte was ill. It's unfortunate, you know, that he decided to take this medical leave. But I really was trying to envision what is it that would actually meet the standards that his doctors have said, that something vague like when the problems are resolved, he can return to work. Does that mean fire everybody who works for WDOC right now and start with a clean slate? Or does that mean an apology? Or does that mean it's so vague, and until he goes through the process, which is available to him at any time, we don't know.
All that would be needed would be some effort by the Department of Corrections to acknowledge that it has been unfair to him and to commit not to do that in the future. That's
See,
all that it would require.
Even if we were to assume that the process that was available to Dr. Witte was hostile or unfair to him at the initial level, didn't he at all times have the ability to get to a neutral arbitrator? And so long as there was a neutral decision maker available to him, how can we say that as a matter of law the process was a sham, particularly in light of the fact, as a judge would point it out, he had prevailed before a neutral arbitrator once before. And, you know, he was ordered reinstated. I mean, surely that is some sort of proof that the process can be effective.
Well, he was ordered reinstated, and then once reinstated, he was victimized two or three times the power of the wrongdoing that occurred prior to that.
Yes,
and
look, we all know that supervisors can make life unbearable, you know, by bringing charge after charge. But so long as he could raise the question of constructive discharge in the grievance process, why should we just let him walk away from that opportunity? I mean, he could have asked for a continuance, couldn't he have? I mean, he just left.
Well, he took a medical leave of absence.
Well, and he walked out of the hearing.
Yes, with the understanding that he was in need of a medical leave of absence beginning immediately because he was suffering from that level of stress that could bring on a heart attack. And then immediately thereafter, he was written at home by the employer, threatening him with the fact that these issues will all be back on the table when you come back, if you come back.
Why is that a threat? I mean, if they were trying to pursue something, and he, for medical reasons, needed, as it were, you know, an adjournment of the proceeding, I don't understand why that, in and of itself, means that the problems shouldn't be looked into. And I would remind you, too, that the Supreme Court has recently spoken even to the subject of constructive discharges. And it the fact that, you know, problems at work are being explored may not be enough to, as everyone likes to say, rise to the level of a constructive discharge. There's no debate, I think, that he has medical issues, right?
Your Honor, the facts of this case are the reason why a jury question of constructive discharge is presented, and are the reason why at least a jury question of whether it would have been futile to pursue arbitration is presented. This is a series of acts and reactions that goes back to 1999. There is a history here of hostility that no person with self-respect could put up with.
But then, can't we look at the facts a little differently? When he was told, you know, that we are going to pursue these things once he was ill, I mean, that to me should encourage him to use. He knows that this is going to come back again, so why shouldn't he take advantage of having a hearing when he's able, particularly when he's won.
Your Honor, we're saying that in this case, the process that is due is a hearing in the federal court on the issue of this relentless string.
Well, I understand
of,
you want to
yes,
be here. I'm saying that there was a process available to him once he healed and he was able to take advantage of that.
Well,
I just want to follow up on that. If your complaint is that they have constructively discharged him without due process, you obviously are talking about post-deprivation mm-hmm. process, you know, as the district court pointed out. I mean, constructive discharges by their nature aren't the kinds of things that you have pre-deprivation process. But you can't at the same time say we're not going to use the process and then say, and you discharge me without due process, because mm-hmm. that's not the way things can work, you know. If it's a due process claim you're making and not, you know, a retaliation claim or a First Amendment claim or any of many other kinds of claims one might make, you can't walk away from the process.
Our point is that he did not walk away from the process, that he took advantage of the process that made sense under the facts of this case and filed a federal lawsuit.
But the federal lawsuit, though, said the state didn't have any post-deprivation process, and that's what he walked away from. He took his medical leave. He at no time, while on leave or otherwise, tried to pursue matters with the state, and now he wants to come into federal court and criticize the state for not giving him process.
Well, the state had given him the same process of arbitration previously.
And he won.
And the situation became calamitously more difficult as a result of his winning.
Well, when the arbitrator says should not be interpreted as an endorsement of Whitty's behavior and attitude, he was on notice that he needed to improve his own performance. Maybe he didn't think so, but he needed to do that.
But the evidence would show that he made every good faith effort to do so, and that in fact he did so. And despite that, he was faced with petty charges and scrutiny that was no one else was subjected to, and literally the use of these hearings as a tool for harassment and infliction of anxiety. If I may reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lasker. Good morning, Mr. Pines.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Lasker. This case does not involve the violation of any due process right of Dr. Whitty's at all. Dr. Whitty had and probably still has, assuming that he was constructively discharged, which the defendants do not concede at all, a right to a full post-deprivation due process hearing.
Mr. Pines,
Is it your position that Dr. Whitty could have raised the issue of constructive discharge by way of a grievance?
Yes.
What meaningful relief could an arbitrator have given him on such a charge?
An arbitrator could have fashioned the relief that would have relieved the problem that Dr. Whitty was able to prove at an arbitration hearing. The problem is that the problem that Dr. Whitty has raised...
Peter Piper, yes.
He has raised as a problem the fact that the Department of Corrections investigates complaints against him. So to the extent that he is asking an arbitrator to give him relief, and the relief he's asking for is that he not be investigated when complaints are made against him, I guess the arbitrator could not provide relief to him. But it's unlikely that he could win an arbitration under those circumstances. I want to point one thing out, that Mr. Lasker, in his presentation, in his brief, in his presentation here today, has consistently referred to evidence of this, evidence of that, evidence of humiliation, evidence of these picayune things that the department was doing. The fact of the matter is that we went through an exhaustive process at the district court of determining what the facts are through Judge Crabb's process that she uses in summary judgment motions, a process that requires each party to propose findings of fact and then to respond to the other party's proposed findings of fact so that the district court determines whether there are material facts in dispute.
Yeah, I mean, Judge Crabb certainly did write a lot, which all three of us experienced for this. I want to go back, though, to the process that's available to him. Is it the case that somebody who is on a medical leave of absence still retains the right to file a grievance and could perhaps even take such a grievance to arbitration before that person returns from the leave, or would he have to return from the leave first and then invoke these various procedures?
If the person who is on a medical leave claims that he has been constructively discharged, he has the right to grieve that to arbitration.
So obviously I'm wondering whether this is the kind of thing that Dr. Whitty, under the procedures that are available to him, could resolve prior to returning to work, that he could file a grievance saying, I've been constructively discharged, ask, you know, first the institution and then ultimately a neutral arbitrator for whatever relief he thinks would be adequate. As I said, I'm a bit unclear as to what that would look like, but maybe he, you know, let's assume he defines it, an apology or something. He could do that while he's still on a medical leave.
Yes.
So he's not in the day-to-day stressful situation of the Racine Correctional Institute.
That's correct.
Okay.
And he would, in that arbitration, have the burden of first proving that he had been constructively discharged.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was starting to say is that when we talk about the evidence in this case, the evidence is, for purposes of this appeal, obviously the court can review the matters de novo and make its own findings of fact. I suggest that the court would be better off looking back on what Judge Crabb did and using that as a starting point at the very least.
Well, of course, we have de novo reviews.
I understand that. If necessary, if this court goes through the very same process that Judge Crabb will do, I would assert that she'll come to the very same conclusion as to that there are no material facts in dispute, and based on the submissions of the parties, there are undisputed facts. But at a minimum, we know this. We know that Dr. Witte was not retaliated against because of the exercise of his First Amendment rights. We know that when he returned to work, there were two complaints that were investigated by the department. One was an investigation of calling a nurse practitioner into his office and having her examine the testicles of an inmate.
I don't understand at all why that's a harassing thing. This is an all-male institution, isn't it?
Yes.
And medical professionals, I would sincerely hope, don't care about what body part needs investigating.
That's true.
I mean, that's just life.
But the facts of that circumstance were that Dr. Witte had examined the inmate and claimed to have invited the nurse practitioner in to show her an unusual case.
Well.
It turned out that from her point of view, it certainly didn't seem that way, and she complained about it, and the department investigated it. And they reprimanded Dr. Witte. The department reprimanded him. He didn't file a grievance about that.
I certainly could understand from a patient point of view, maybe wanting to have a same-sex nurse or something. I mean, they're things, but I really find it beyond odd to think that would be an abusive practice. It would really certainly change medical ethics.
Well, but in any case, the department disagreed with that view, and the department had a mild discipline of Dr. Witte, which he didn't challenge. But he claims here, and he claims, I didn't have my due process rights. He didn't even challenge that. He didn't challenge the reprimand about his conduct with regard to the health services unit manager, Kim Russell. He was reprimanded for threatening to file complaints about her, and he didn't grieve that. But yet now he's here saying, I didn't have due process. He didn't use the process that was available to him when he had that opportunity. The evidence in the case does not support the notion at all that there was harassment of Dr. Witte when he returned to work. That is not evidence that is in the record. What's in the record is an affidavit from Dr. Witte, which contains conclusory statements.
Well, there's also the affidavit of his union representative who indicating that, you know, he observed blatant prejudice against Dr. Witte on the part of at least three of the individuals.
And I think if the court examines the affidavit of that individual, the court will conclude, as I believe that Judge Crabb concluded, although I'm not certain on this point, but I believe that the court will look at that and see that that affidavit itself is not sufficient evidence, that it's not really evidentiary in accord with Rule 56, that it's a bunch of conclusory statements. There's nothing in the affidavit that supports the conclusory statements. There's no observations. Why was this harassing? The assertion is made. No one else has been treated that way, yet there's no evidence about how other people were treated. There's affidavits about, the affidavit says this was terrible harassment, something to that effect, but there's nothing that specifies what it was about the conduct that was actually harassing. It's all a bunch of conclusory statements, which is not evidentially sufficient for this matter to go to trial.
So what would it take? I mean, it seems to me when you have a claim that process itself has been used in a harassing and sham fashion, you know, I don't know whether you would need evidence such as, you know, the nurse wasn't even on duty that day and so she couldn't have been the one called into the room, you know, something to show that it was really a sham. Because, you know, if you really want to reprimand people for every last little offensive remark they make, you would do nothing but hold due process hearings at the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. And so I think that's the gist of Dr. Witte's claim, isn't it, that he's being called up in things that, frankly, nobody else would be called
up
on.
Well, if that was Dr. Witte's claim, then it was incumbent upon him to produce even a little bit of evidence to show that the department operated differently towards him than, say, towards other doctors or towards other employees. But there isn't any evidence at all to support that assertion. None.
How many doctors were there at Racine? Was he the only doctor? Were there a couple of doctors?
At one point, there were two doctors there. Mm-hmm. I believe when Dr. Witte returned, my recollection of the record is that there were two doctors there. There are doctors at all of the correctional institutions in Wisconsin. They are all supervised by the same supervisors. So to the extent that any of them were subjected to any discipline, there could have been a comparison to how they were treated. Or there could have been a comparison general to how other health professionals were treated. But there's no evidence of that. There's a sole affidavit of the union representative saying, basically, it is my opinion that this stuff was petty, is not evidence. Certainly not evidence enough to defeat the motion for summary judgment. The point about evidence is really quite important.
Well, his affidavit indicated that he personally observed blatant prejudice.
Right. But he never said, other than that conclusory statement, what that blatant prejudice was. And I believe that the rulings of this court and really the terms of Rule 56 and the evidence required under Rule 56 doesn't allow conclusory statements like that to defeat a motion for summary judgment. As this court has said, and I cited the case in my brief, summary judgment motions are the put-up or shut-up time in a lawsuit. If you've got evidence, you've got to put that evidence forward. I wanted to take a moment to comment on the additional claim under 895, just to say that claim really was raised only in a surreply brief during the summary judgment. I don't believe that was adequately raised in the district court and argued in the district court or preserved for this court. But to the extent that it was, the important point, I think, to be made about this 895.65.2 is that the statute protects an employee who has exercised First Amendment rights by lawfully disclosing information or because the employer or employer's agent believes the employee so expressed his or her rights, that is, expressed them through disclosing information that's First Amendment protected. It's basically, it's a whistleblower statute. Now, here we have the situation where Dr. Witte himself was known to be a person who was writing these letters which contained some matters of public concern, but which Judge Crabb said were not protected speech. Then the notion then that the employer somehow thought that this speech was protected and was harassing him, if we accept that, the statute can be interpreted to cover that situation.
That doesn't seem like such a preposterous thing to me, though. I mean, I'm sure you've looked at this court's line of Pickering-Connick cases, and this is not the crispest of lines, you know, which speech winds up on balance after you finish all of these things being constitutionally protected. So an employer might actually erroneously think something is protected and then retaliate. I don't think it's impossible at all, actually.
Well, let's assume that to be the case. There is no evidence in this record whatsoever to support the assertion that this statute has been violated under that interpretation. That no one has found or presented one scintilla of evidence that it was Dr. Witte's, that it was the perception of the decision makers that Dr. Witte had engaged in protected speech, and then based on that perception that they retaliated against him in some way. That is, Dr. Witte had a lot of complaints about a lot of people and about a lot of things. But there's no evidence that he was retaliated against because of that behavior. And we can, you can search the record, and it's not there. And that, I think, is fundamental to whatever interpretation the court makes of 8-95-65 paren 2, which the Wisconsin courts have not interpreted. And I am not suggesting that this court certify it to the Wisconsin courts to be interpreted, even though I really like the Wisconsin courts. But I think this case should be resolved here. The fact of the matter is that there was an absolute failure of factual proof or presentation of facts in this case that led to the grant of summary judgment in favor of the defendants. And Judge Crabb's analysis of the due process claim, I think, is absolutely right. That this is not a claim that Dr. Witte was retaliated against and denied his due process. He had due process available. He didn't take advantage of it. The district court should be affirmed. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. How much time?
Like 4 minutes.
Thank you.
There is so much to be said in rebuttal. I hope I can do it in 4 minutes, but I'm going to try to click some things off here. First of all, the preposterousness of that charge about the nurse practitioner looking at the genitals of the inmate. That was a preposterous charge. That was Dr. Witte's defense against it. What are you talking about? Any medical the practitioner would not complain about this. And when he was reprimanded for it, he did not grieve it because the grievance would have been heard by the powers that be that were already putting him through sham processes.
But that's a very unsatisfactory place to... I mean, it sort of means he's exempted himself from all of the procedures the institution has. And I have to say, if there had been a hypothetical grievance, the facts of what happened could have been looked into, as I certainly think. I mean, from a medical professional point of view, it really shouldn't matter. On the other hand, we sadly enough see some instances in which doctors approach things with the wrong tone, if you will. So, you know, I don't know. The problem is he never filed a grievance, and so he never gave the situation a chance to work. And when I think of the harsh exhaustion requirements we impose on the prisoners themselves, we basically say to them, we don't care if it's absolutely pointless. You still have to go through the institution's procedures. It seems to me not so much to say that you should file something.
Thank you. The direct evidence in this case I want to bring to your attention. Dr. Daly, his boss, saying to him that they want you to shut up, that there's a campaign against you to deliberately treat you unfairly, is admissible evidence. The memo from Kasperson to his staff talking about a termination effort, the memo from Bennett to his staff talking about executing the exit strategy for Witte. And the facts in the Swanson affidavit, please read it. He does give specific facts. He talks about the fact that they would not listen to Witte, that they would not consider the possibility of anybody else being at fault, and that and other things that are about the most objective evidence that one can put into an affidavit, other than to say that I've been through every single one of these things and I've seen the pattern that I'm here to report about. I hope that the court will recognize that this case is very similar to the Perrette case that I cite in my brief, also similar to the Chichen case and the Levenstein case and the Williams versus Waste Management and Hunt versus City of Markham and EEOC versus University of Chicago Hospital and the Eighth Circuit case of White versus Honeywell, all of which were cases where the standards for constructive discharge were laid out and meet the facts of this case, we respectfully submit. We would ask that the court do a de novo review of the evidence. In this case, as you know, I've argued in my brief that the failure to correct the improper application of the Rule 56 standards in this case would violate my client's constitutional right to a jury determination of the facts. And I did do it in less than 4 minutes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both Mr. Lasker and Mr. Pines, and the case will be taken under advisement.